The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. I am Gina Mastrangeli. I've been a member of this fellowship for many, many years, and I thank you all for attending the service this morning. Whether you're here in the building or online, you're welcome. We extend a special welcome to any visitors here this morning. And this is second Sunday of the month, which is our brunch Sunday. So we invite you to stay, share our food and our potluck. There's always lots of food. And let us know who you are and have some conversation with us. We have all sorts of interesting conversation going during brunch. I'm sure you can find one table. You can find somebody you'd like to talk to. For those online, if you're new, we have an online visitor chat card that you can share and we'll get in touch with you, so please sign that. We at Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, we are a caring community. We aspire to empower people to grow spiritually, nurture one another, and work for justice and stewardship of the earth. So whoever you are, whatever your background, wherever you are on your spiritual journey, we welcome each other into our circle of love and compassion and joy. Our topic this morning is art and being human. Our guest speaker, Jan Trotnier, is from Unitarian Congregation of Westchester. She's an art historian, and she will touch upon how throughout the ages, art was an essential part, and is, of the human experience. Art is more than just an interesting object to observe, that by creating and experiencing art, it also offers an opportunity to dive into our souls, connect with the spirit of life, and reach beyond ourselves that we might transcend difficulty, harshness, suffering. So let us now open our service as we do each Sunday by lighting our chalice, the symbol of our liberal religious faith. And then we'll follow it by lighting the peace lamp. Nikki and Indigo Mulholland will lead us.
Painters by Morel Rochester. In a cave with a long ago flare, a woman stands, her arms up. Red twig, black twig, brown twig. A wall of leaping darkness over her. The men are out hunting in the early light, but there's this flicker. One or two men, painting, and a woman among them. Great living animals grow on the stone walls, their pelts, their eyes, their sex, their hearts. And the cave painters touch them with life. Red, brown, black, a woman among them, painting. Oh, may peace be with us.
The children are now welcome to leave for their classes. We look now.
Everywhere you may go.
Okay. I met our speaker this morning, Jan Trottinier, through Art Goes to School. Art Goes to School is a volunteer art appreciation program that serves the elementary schools. And she belongs to Westchester, to the Westchester chapter, so in Art Goes to School. And really, I could talk forever about all her talents and her accomplishments, but she has a lot of interesting things to say, so I'm going to sort of let you, you discover that as she talks. But that in addition to giving to the elementary schools through our Art Goes to School organization, she enjoys sharing her passion of art with people of all ages, retirement communities, libraries, and high schools. A year ago, she gave this talk to Art Goes to School, and afterwards I thought, oh boy, this would make a wonderful service at Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. And when I asked her, she says, geez, I thought I'd covered my tracks. I created the program for my Unitarian Church in Westchester. So with that, Jan.
Next slide, please. You probably know that all human groups create art. Not every human creates art. Many of us are not gifted in this way, myself included. But all human groups do create art. And we as a species are the only ones on our planet who create art. You probably already know that, but the point I want to make today is that this ability that we have and that we alone have is costing us. It has costed us from the beginning, and it continues to cost some of us even today. It requires a great many resources, creativity, etc., and sometimes one must overcome great pain in order to create art. It's part of our essence as human beings. We have created art as a species or as individuals, even while suffering the torments of hell on earth. We have created it when it took our valuable resources, when we lived in very challenging places and times where we could have been using that creativity and resources just to survive. And we create art even in the face of serious handicaps. Today, we're going to talk about how essential art is and has been to us humans, so essential that creating it we did even when it was dangerous or painful, and even when it cost us a lot. And by the end of our talk today, I hope to achieve two ends: that we attain a deeper understanding of ourselves as people, and also to an understanding that art is not just something that you hang on the wall behind your sofa. It's an essential element to us as human beings. Next slide, please. So let's step way back in time, before the time of the Great Pyramids, before there were cities, before people even knew the use of the wheel. When archaeologists research these ancient peoples, they find remains. They find that they buried their dead and that they made art. What were these Stone Age people like? We all have an image in our heads of somebody whose knuckles are dragging on the ground and they're extremely heavy and their brow comes in 10 minutes before they do. But in fact, these people were us. They were closely related to us as a species, or they actually were our very own species, which is what? Homo sapiens sapiens, exactly. So they told jokes. They cooed over their babies and talked baby language. They worshiped in some way. We don't know about those things, but we know that they did them in some way. Let's have a look at the art they left behind. And as we go through these, next slide, please. As we go through some of these pictures of cave art, I want you to think about two things. Number one, it's all in caves. And number two, many of these animals are what are called megafauna. What's mega mean? Big, because some of them were really big, and these images are even life-size or sometimes larger, so very, very big. Okay, so yes, thank you. You can continue going. Slide next. These are all from caves in France, and they were created 17,000 to 20,000 years ago. Next slide, please. So what is it, has anybody ever been in a cave? What's it like? If we turn off the lights in here, will it be like in a cave? No, we have plenty of light coming in. Is it like when you go in the closet, the coat closet, and the light switch doesn't work? No, that's relatively light in comparison. It's super, super dark. It's cold. You're not going to freeze to death in 10 minutes. It's about 50 degrees, but it's a damp, chilly cold that would lead to hypothermia if you were there for any long amount of time and not moving around. And it's dangerous. What? Yes, thank you. you read my mind. Next slide, please. Or yeah, just there you go. Next. Next. Yes. And then next. There we go. So what kind of dangers are there in caves? Well, there are slippery surfaces because there can be underground bodies of water and because it's very, very humid. It's jagged rocks that are slippery. You could easily fall and hurt yourself. There can be passageways that are so narrow that you have to get on your belly and creep through like a snake. There could be underground bodies of water that, because of the darkness, you might fall into. You could get lost, and you might never find your way back again. There might be other inhabitants of the cave. There could be cave lions, cave bears, cave tigers, cave wolves, and even more frightening of all, cave Homo sapiens sapiens, others that are not in your group who might attack you or something. There could be diminished oxygen. All of these things are very, very dangerous, and no telling how many dozens, hundreds, or even thousands of our early human ancestors died trying to make art in caves. Next slide, please. So when we think about technology, if I ask this young lady, Indigo, here, I'm going to put you on the spot because you are up here and I know you feel comfortable. Give me an example of technology. Like a cell phone. Excellent. And everyone in her generation will say the same thing first, a cell phone or an iPad. But humans have used technology since we were humans. Technology is just making stuff for a practical purpose. So what kind of technology would cave people be using in order to get down in these caves and create that amazing art? Well, we talked about how, next please, we talked about how it was super, super dark. You're going to need some kind of a lamp. Next. Are you going to go to Home Depot and buy one of those cool things that you put on your forehead and walk around with? Nope. Are you going to use a candle? Nope. You're going to have to fashion a lamp out of stone. And you do this with the same process that stone axes were made. You make a little lamp, and you see some examples right here. You put, it's about the size of my palm, and in it you put a lump of fat, animal fat. You didn't buy it at Giant. Animal fat that you yourself could have eaten, because as we all know, fat tastes good and has lots of calories. So what kind of light do you get from one of these lamps? Well, it's not going to be very much light. I mean, you know, this would probably make it look very bright. It is going to be flickering, which is going to mean everything around you is going to look like it's moving because of that flickeringness. The little wick would be made out of straw, most likely. Next. What other kinds of technology would you need? Well, you're going to need, if you're going to paint, you're going to need colors, which we call pigments. This bull's snout is made from a pigment that's called manganese oxide or hausmannite. It's at the Lascaux Cave in France. There is none of this mineral in deposits near Lascaux today and doesn't look as though there was even back in the time that this was painted. So how did they get it? The nearest deposit is 150 miles away in the mountains between France and Spain, the Pyrenees. How did they get it? Was somebody from their group running over there 150 miles in order to acquire this? Were there traders coming through? Were there people migrating from this area and bringing it? We don't know, but somebody spent a lot of time trying to get this exact color of black. A lot of trouble went into getting it. So what other stuff would you need to be painting in a cave? You're going to need something to apply those pigments. So you could make a brush out of a stick with some leaves or twigs or animal hairs bound to it with ligaments of some kind. You could use moss pads of some kind for like a paint roller effect. You could use your own hand, but you had to get something. And next, please. Remember that many of these images are larger than life, so bigger than me. I'm not nearly as big as an aurochs, which is an ancient like buffalo type animal. You're gonna need something to climb up on. You can't reach that high. So some kind of scaffolding. This is a whole bunch of stuff to be carrying around in one of these dark, dangerous caves with all the water, slippery surfaces, cave bears, et cetera, et cetera. Next, please. And being humans and smart, we're not going to just try to carry those things under our arms. We're going to have some sort of a tote, maybe made of animal skin, to carry all of our stuff around. Lots and lots of creativity and energy and thought have to go into painting in these caves. All of those qualities could have been used to make living in a harsh landscape at a difficult time a little easier. But instead, people devoted those resources to making art. Next, please. All the time that you spent trying to find those pigments, the special little pads that you want to use out of moss to put the pigments on, the bag, the scaffolding, the people, the resources, the fat that you could have eaten and energized yourself instead of using it to light your way. Many, many resources went into creating the art, and the people making it had to face a lot of danger. Enormous outlays in labor, creativity, and resources, not used for living, but for creating art. And another surface we could talk about why, because no one really knows why this art was created. At this point, there is no consensus. And now I invite you to turn in your hymnals or sing along with our hymn, the words of Where Do We Come From? The lyrics for this were written by the artist Paul Gauguin.
Where do we come from? What are we? Where are we going? Where do we come from? What are we? Where are we going? Where do we come from? What are we? Where are we going? Where do we come from? Where do we come from? Mystery, mystery. Life is a riddle and a mystery, mystery, mystery. Life is a riddle and a mystery. Where do we come from?
guy looked amazingly like Paul Gauguin. It's amazing. Thanks for choosing that, Gina. Next slide, please. Let us turn to a much more painful look at the importance of art to being human. What happens to art when human beings are subjected to hell on earth? Let's think about the art that was created in Nazi concentration camps. Most prisoners who had artistic talent had to risk their very lives to express their art. The Nazis did not want there to exist any documentation of what was going on in the camps. In the camps where the Nazis sought to obliterate people's humanity, for example, by giving them uniforms and taking their names and giving them a number, art still survived. In many instances, art created by prisoners, again, at the risk of their own lives many times, is the only documentation that we have of what went on in the camps. But sometimes artists depicted beauty also, a butterfly landing on a barbed wire fence, or a picture of two friends picking flowers in a field, somebody remembering a beautiful memory. And they showed that although they were in prison, these people had souls that were free. The human soul, the human spirit, the human desire to make art is indomitable, and it speaks to the essential humanness of creating art. And of course, a lot of times, being an artist in a camp was punishable by torture or death or deprivation of something necessary, such as food, and there were no art supplies per se. Most of the time that people had to create art using materials that they scrounged or stole. Next slide, please. A case in point, and there are many, Peter Gintz was born in 1928 in Prague. His dad was Jewish and his mother was Christian. He was a very intellectually curious person and had a lot of talent. By the age of 14, he had already written 5 novels, for example, The Wizard from the Altai Mountains and Around the World in 1 Second. He was clearly a Jules Verne fan, and he illustrated his books himself. I like to think about Peter Gintz and what he did. You know, kids today have Minecraft. Peter Gintz had Around the World in 1 day. But he was the child of a mixed marriage, and he was taken away to a concentration camp away from his family when he was 14. He was taken to Terezin, or Terezinstadt, which is in Czechoslovakia. Even there, he continued to write and draw, and with some other people, put out a bi-weekly magazine called Vedem, which means in the lead in Czech, somehow, as well as writing poems, short stories, and descriptions of life in Terezin. Now, Terezin was seen or created by the Nazis as sort of a model showplace to deflect the world's attention from what was going on in other camps. And so the rules concerning art were a little bit more relaxed. They were not, the prisoners were not allowed to document what was actually going on, but they could, with some degree of freedom, create this magazine. How did they do, what supplies did they use? Well, prisoners were allowed, when they were deported from the ghettos of Eastern Europe, to bring 110 pounds of luggage. And there were people who brought in art supplies. There was one very heroic art teacher, Frieda Dickel-Brandeis, who used almost all of her 110 pound allotment for art supplies. And of course, they did borrow materials from the offices, you know, things like wrapping paper and office forms and supplies of various things. The cover of Vedem, the magazine, had a book which symbolized learning, and it showed a rocket ship. I like to think that Peter Gintz made up the rocket ship because that meant the future. It was heading for a star. Next slide, please. And this picture is the genesis of this talk. I saw this picture, and I want you to notice the size, 8x6. So, you know, it's teeny tiny. It's very small. He did this in 1942, between 42 and 44. 14 to 16 years old, years, decades before the space program. He is envisioning the Earth. See the Earth? You can see the continents. You can see the continents on the Earth, and he is envisioning this as having been seen from the moon. I just find that astonishing. And this was created by a young man who was suffering terribly. There were near starvation rations at Taliesin. There were brutal work details for everyone 14 and up, which of course included Peter. Unsanitary conditions, 100 children and 2 toilets, for example. There was infectious disease, and then there was the constant threat of the next transport to the death camp of Auschwitz. But Peter kept his amazing imagination and expressed it in his art and did this wonderful picture. Art survived even hell on Earth. He was such a science fiction fan. I know he would love to know that an asteroid has been named after him. Asteroid Peter Gintz. And there's another scientific connection that's sadder. The Israeli astronaut Ilan Ramon, whose mother and grandmother had survived the Holocaust, carried a copy of this picture with him when he went up on the space shuttle Columbia, which exploded February 1st, 2003. I'm not making it up. And a cruel twist of fate, that day would have been Peter Gintz's 75th birthday. Next slide. Of the 15,000 total children sent to Taliesin, 100 survived. Peter was not one of them. He was put on one of the last transports to Auschwitz in September 44 and gassed. His sister Chava recently put together his diary and had it published. She too is an artist. Next slide, please. Now, Peter Gintz spoke Czech, Esperanto, and some Yiddish. I like to think that his mother may have sung him this song, which we're going to play from YouTube by Chava Albertstein. And the text of the Yiddish for at least the first verse is on the left-hand side. The right-hand, of course, has the English. You'll notice many correspondences between the two. Of course, Yiddish and English are closely related. And
Ich liebe Kinderlach, der Frühling schon beginnt, der Frühling schon beginnt. Oi, wie bin ich Kinderlach, me kann ne Eiche zinden. Oi, wie bin ich Kinderlach, me kann ne Eiche zinden. Huliet, huliet, Kinderlach, kos man, ihr seid noch jung. Weil von Frühling bis zum Winter ist der Katzensprung. Ich liebe Kinderlach, versäumt kein Augenblick, versäumt kein Augenblick. Nehmt mich euch herein ins Spiel, verginnt mir euch das Glück. Nehmt mich euch herein ins Spiel, verginnt mir euch das Glück. Hüllet, hüllet, Kinderlach, kos man, ihr seid noch jung. Weil von Frühling bis zum Winter ist der Katzensprung. Guckt nicht auf mein grauen Kopf, zerstört das Eichenspiel, zerstört das Eichenspiel. Meine Schomme ist noch jung, wird zurück mit Jahren viel. Meine Schomme ist noch jung, wird zurück mit Jahren viel. Huliet, huliet, Kinderlach, kos man, ihr seid noch jung. Weil von Frühling bis zum Winter ist der Katzensprung. Meine Schomme ist noch jung und geht von Bankschaft aus, und geht von Bankschaft aus. Ach, wie gern will sich ihr von alten Guffer reus. Ach, wie gern will sich ihr von alten Guffer reus. Huliet, huliet, Kinderlach, kos man, ihr seid noch jung. Weil von Frühling bis zum Winter ist der Katzensprung. spielt euch, liebe Kinder, ach, versäumt kein Augenblick, versäumt kein Augenblick, weil der Frühling eckt sich bald mit ihm das höchste Glück, weil der Frühling eckt sich bald mit ihm das höchste Glück. Ja, huiet, huiet, Kinder, ach, als Mann, ihr seid noch jung, weil von Frühling bis zum Winter ist ein Katzensprung.
Fahr vom Frühling bis zum Winter ist ein Katzensprung.
I love that. We have lots of Katzen at our house and we have a lot of springing too. Okay, next slide, please. So individual, we've been talking about a group, us as humans and then Peter Gynt. Individuals can also suffer from tremendous disabilities and even then continue to make art. There are many, many, many examples of this, and we'll just talk about two of them today. The first one is Pierre-Auguste Renoir. Next slide, please. Whose work is probably familiar to many of you. In his youth, he did many of these very lighthearted scenes, and you can see the size of it. It's 6 feet wide, and he was out there painting people in plein air, in outside in the streets of Paris. Next, please. Or visiting the banks of the Seine River for a boating party. Next slide, please. But already in his 40s, Renoir began to suffer from arthritis, and he was in constant pain in the last three decades of his life. He also broke his right arm in a fall from a bicycle, and it was the second fall he had had. So he's 50 years old, and he's broken his arm for the second time with arthritis. He had already taught himself how to paint with his non-dominant left hand when he broke it the first time. So he had a resource. He did have an extra hand. But he did also have arthritis, which made these little brush strokes pretty difficult. Towards the end of his life, he suffered a stroke and was confined to a wheelchair, unable to walk. But he continued to paint regardless. His will to create kept him sitting at his easel. His hands were bandaged to protect his very thin skin, and he would hold his paintbrush, you know, normally you would hold it like this where you have more control, but he had to sort of hold it between his thumb and his fist, you know, to be able to move it at all. His son, who was the famous filmmaker, said his hands were terribly deformed by arthritis. Visitors who were unprepared for this could not take their eyes off his deformity. Though they did not dare to mention it, their reaction would be expressed by some such phrase as, "It isn't possible. With hands like that, how can he paint those pictures?" Next slide, please. Here is a self-portrait he did towards the end of his life. He died in 1919, and it's a self-portrait because rather than being able to go march around the streets of Paris and set up an easel at the Moulin Rouge or go to the banks of the Seine to see a boating party, he's much more confined to his home. But he still is creating art. His brush strokes changed. He used to have lots of little dabs, but his hands are too painful, and so he has much more thoughtful strokes of paint towards the end of his life. He lived to see one of his paintings purchased by the Louvre and to be able to go and visit it, a place where he himself had often gone lost in rapture at seeing all of the art. At the age of 72, he said, "I am just learning how to paint." Only he said it in French. Next. Yes. His friend Henri Matisse, the artist, said, "Renoir was nothing but aches and pains. After half an hour, when he was busy painting, it was as if he had been brought back from death. I have never seen such a happy man." So he's overcoming a broken arm twice, arthritis, and towards the end of his life, a crippling stroke. Next slide, please. Let's turn now to an artist who's closer to home, and that is Horace Pippin, who was born right in Westchester and lived most of his life here in southeastern PA. Next slide, please. Here is a tiny self-portrait that he did. It's about the same size as Peter Gynt's picture of the Earth from the Moon. Very, very small picture. It's his self-portrait. Next slide. Horace Pippin's grandparents had been slaves, and he lived for a time in New York State, but returned to Westchester as an adult and lived there most of his life. He left school at the age of 15 to help support his mother and worked a variety of menial jobs like stable hand and coal porter, etc. Jobs we don't really have too much these days. His passion for art was apparent even when he was still in elementary school. These are his spelling words from probably first or second grade, and I like the way that he has illustrated them. His teacher didn't approve of that too much. And I want you to especially notice the wavy water in the dishpan. Next page. Pippin started painting at the age of 40 in 1928, and that's kind of surprising. 40 is kind of late in your life to take up what would become a new career. Plus, it's 10 years after the end of the war that he painted multiple times. This is his first surviving painting. He had enlisted as a soldier at the age of 29 in 1917 in the Great War, that is World War I, and he was with a unit that came to be called the Harlem Hellfighters. He rose to corporal, by the way. The armed forces were segregated in those days, and the races certainly did not enjoy equal treatment. Black soldiers were typically ill-equipped, both from a training standpoint and from a munitions standpoint. Pippin's unit shipped out to the bloody battlefields of France with about 2 weeks of training. But his unit, the Harlem Hellfighters, became famous for their bravery. In October of 1918, he was shot in his dominant right arm and shoulder by a German sniper who used what are called dum-dum bullets. These are bullets that explode on impact, which created a huge furrow, a trench in his arm, and almost severed it. He was eventually fitted with a steel plate to help keep his arm together. He would deal with the trauma of what he had seen and experienced in World War I for the rest of his life. He probably suffered from what we today call post-traumatic stress disorder. Yes, thank you. In those days, it was just known as shell shock because the grenades and things that they threw were called shells. One of the ways he dealt with his emotions was by painting. He wanted to chronicle his war experiences, perhaps as a means of catharsizing his emotional trauma. This one is called Ending of the War, Starting Home. Now, because he was wounded in October 1918, when is the end of the war? Hans? November 1918. So just a month before the end of the war, he was wounded and basically sent home. So he wasn't there to see the ceasefire, but this is his version of it. He tells us that he had worked on the painting for 3 years and it has hundreds of coats of paint. You can see, next please. The soldiers that he depicts are all African-American. The American soldiers are all African-American. It's hard to see them. That's why I circled them, because it's dark and it's kind of light in here. Next, please. Next, please. Ah, yes. So take a look. He made the frame also, and he sculpted out of wood and then attached with glue these elements on the frame that you see all around here. On the sides, on the left, you see the German helmet. On the right, the French helmet. At the top, the English helmet. These kind of details bring home to us. This was somebody to whom these kind of details really meant something. Next, please. So it's 2 inches, you know, it sticks out from the surface about 2 inches. I'm not talking about the frame, I'm talking about the actual painting now, because he put so many layers of paint on there. So he is going to be painting the war for the rest of his life. Not just the war, by no means, but he certainly continues to return to it for the remaining decades of his life. Next slide, please. So because he had suffered this tremendous injury, he had to develop a new way of painting for himself so he would be able to do it. If you can see it's not very clear, but he is holding his right arm, because remember he's right-handed, with his left and using it to guide, he uses his non-dominant hand to guide his right hand in painting. Not a very agile way to wield a paintbrush, I think we would all agree. But he was so intent on painting that once he had worked out how to do this, he would paint sometimes for 17 hours at a time. Next slide, please. He started attracting local interest when he exhibited his paintings in Chester County, and there are legends that N.C. Wyeth had a hand in bringing him to the attention of art dealers, including the famous Mr. Albert Barnes, who bought a number of his works. His work ended up at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York City, at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., and in our very own Barnes collection here in Philadelphia. He actually did spend a couple of weeks studying at the Barnes Foundation, and that would be his only formal art training, but he found it underwhelming. His favorite artist was actually Pierre-Auguste Renoir. Next, please. Oh yes, I wanted to call your attention to this one. This picture was made towards the end of his life, and he's still making that little wavy picture. I love it when you see consistencies from childhood to late adulthood. Next, please. Horace Pippin said, That guy, Renoir, he was pretty good, and he left a little bit for me too. Next slide, please. This picture he died in 46, so this was done in 1945, 1 year before he died. Obviously, he continues to think about the war. In the foreground, you see the traditional view from a Bible verse, I think it's from Isaiah, about the lamb lying down with the lion or something like that. So the animals who normally would be preying on one another are living in peace and harmony. But in the background, next please, it's hard to see, but you see the little white things on the left-hand side? Those are grave markers. And if you look very carefully in the background, it's very hard to see. There are soldiers with guns, or there are people with guns, we assume soldiers, running, and there's a tank. So even though you have this peaceful scene in the front, the war is still there. And I think that's like a metaphor for maybe his mind. He's living in peace, but he's not in the war, but it's still in him. And next, please. That date that he puts on here was actually August 9th, 1945. Next, please. It's down there at the bottom right, which is the date that the atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. Next, please. Next, please. So let us now enjoy together a hymn very much inspired by this last picture. Well, it's right here. I'm going to lay down my sword and shield.
I'm going to lay down my burden. Down by the riverside, down by that river, down by that riverside, gonna lay down my burden, down by that riverside, study. Whoa. dirty war no more. Dirty war no more. Lay down my fallen shield.
Down by the riverside.
Down by the riverside.
Down by the riverside.
Don't lay down my fallen shield.
Down by the riverside.
Thank you, Jan. Grandpa Elliot, who is featured in Playing for Change, is a street singer in New Orleans, and he's blind. And I discovered Playing for Change in my 15-year hiatus from going to Thomas Paine UU Fellowship on a Sunday morning on one of the Sunday morning talk shows. There's this group called Playing for Change, and what they started was bringing together street singers from all over the world, bringing them, they're all singing, they bring the songs together, and the whole idea is that through music, we will connect as human beings and maybe relate to each other, know each other, and instead of warring, have peace. So the whole idea is to change through music, another medium of art. Now is the time in the program that we are now the matters of the heart, where we can share our joys, our concerns, our sorrows. We will share first in the building here. You can come up to the microphone and then online. I will now turn this part of the program over to John, who is our tech guru, who will give more detailed instructions.
At this time, I will turn it back over to Gina to bring this time of sharing to a close.
Okay, thank you. Our song responds to this morning's program and to our members' joys, concerns, and sorrows is hymn 1009. If you have a hymnal, or you can read the lyrics and sing to the lyrics on the screen. It's Meditation on Breathing.
When I breathe in, I'll breathe in peace when I breathe out. I'll breathe out love when I breathe in. I'll breathe in peace when I breathe out. I'll breathe out love when I breathe in. I'll breathe in peace when I breathe out. I'll breathe out love when I breathe in. I'll breathe in peace when I breathe out. I'll breathe out love when I breathe in. I'll breathe in peace when I breathe out. I'll breathe out. I breathe in.
I breathe in.
I'll breathe in peace when I breathe out.
I breathe out.
I'll breathe out love when I breathe in.
I breathe in.
I'll breathe in peace when I breathe out.
I breathe out.
I'll breathe out love when I breathe in. When I breathe out, I'll breathe out love when I breathe in. I'll breathe in peace when I breathe out. I'll breathe out love.
Hey, Jan will lead us in extinguishing the chalice.
My aim today was to show you that art is part of us, no matter what it might cost us as individuals or as a group. We create art, no matter the danger, no matter the difficulty, no matter the pain. Let's end today's talk with an exhortation, and you may join with reading it with me, if you want to. As we go forth, before all those young, that is station, let us be mother, let us call up the magic of creation by which we build the world of our soul and teach its wisdom to others, young and old. Go now with magic in your fingertips, touch this world with life.
Okay, for announcements, Preston, and then afterwards we have our postlude is another playing for change. It's Everlasting Arms, which features Dr. John.